The sky darkened as we left the main streets behind and headed into the more dangerous alleys beyond. I'd never stepped foot in this part of the city before. The buildings were crammed close together, bending slightly over the street, as though threatening anyone who dared walk beneath. The streets smelled, too, of waste and rot and too many bodies crammed together. Madeline strode ahead, nodding for me to follow her. She led us deeper into the maze of streets, until she stopped before a rickety door. Young voices shouted from inside. I forced myself to take a steadying breath as Madeline knocked on the door. The woman who finally answered was in her 60s, with cropped gray hair and wrinkles around her eyes. She looked completely exhausted, but she beamed when she saw Madeline. "Lady Madeline," she said, "you're back. I'm so glad. I worried when I heard what happened at the palace." "I wasn't there, Susan," Madeline said. "I was all right. But I brought you a visitor." She gestured at me. "May I introduce you to Her Majesty Queen Freya? I've told her all about your work here, and she wanted to come and visit."
"Oh!"
Susan stared at me for a long moment, her mouth open. Then she seemed to realize what she was doing and sank into a curtsy.
"It is an honor to have you here, Your Majesty. I'm afraid the place is a bit of a mess. The children, you know, they can be quite a handful."
I wasn't sure what to say in response to that, so I just nodded.
"Please, come in, come in."
She tried to beckon Madeline forward, while also curtsying respectfully to me. She didn't entirely succeed. The inside of the building did not match Susan's warm demeanor. The stone walls were damp and bare, with mold growing near the ceiling. A few cracks ran up from the floor, and the few pieces of furniture had more repairs than actual material. The sounds of children playing and screaming echoed from somewhere above us. Susan must have seen my surprised expression. "I know, Your Majesty. It's not suitable at all, but it's the best we can do, really, with the money we have. Can I help?" "That's very kind, Your Majesty. We always appreciate donations of anything, food and clothes and toys as well as money, but, well..." She pressed her lips together. "If you don't mind my saying so, Your Majesty, we need a lot more. You're helping us just by being here, making people take notice, but the children need more than donations. They need more than this place." That was fairly clear. I'd always felt so sorry for myself, the awkward girl who never fit in, but I'd had a home, and my father, and enough money that I'd never even thought about it. I'd been such an idiot. "What happened to them?" "Many things. They all lost their parents, one way or another. I used to just take in orphans, but when people heard about my work, they started leaving babies on the doorstep. There's nowhere else for them to go, you know. The older ones are on the street, otherwise, while the younger ones just starve." A little girl appeared in the doorway to the left. She had wisp blonde hair that hung to her waist, and freckles all over her face. She scowled at me. "Who are you?" The question came out as a challenge. I moved closer to her. Her front tooth was missing. "I'm Freya," I said. "I'm a friend of Madeline's. What's your name?"
"Lucy."
She continued to scowl at me.
"Have you come to play with us?"
I nodded, and Lucy reached out to grab my hand.
"We don't play in this room," she said firmly. "It's not allowed."
"All right." Lucy looked me up and down again.
"Are you a princess?"
"No," I said softly. "Not a princess."
"I'm so sorry, Your Majesty," Susan said, hurrying forward. "Lucy, this is Queen Freya. She's the woman in charge of the entire kingdom."
Lucy did not look impressed. She stuck up her chin.
I'm going to be a princess, she said, almost daring me to disagree. When I'm grown up.
Lucy, I've told you, Susan said,
her voice harsher now.
Only very special people are queens and princesses. They're not like you and me. I'm sorry, she added again, seeming to address everyone in the room.
But I didn't want her to be sorry. I knelt in front of Lucy. Small children usually made me uncomfortable. You never quite knew what they were going to do. But Lucy would clearly not accept uncertainty or dismissal.
I wasn't a princess, I said. I was never one of those special people.
And I became queen. Lucy nodded, like she suspected it all along.
We can only play in the playroom, she said, as she let go of my hand. You should come.
And she strode away.
I mean no disrespect, Your Majesty, Susan said, but I do wish you hadn't told her that. It's no good to give them false hope. What these children need is food, a home, a chance for work when they're older, maybe. Hope won't keep them alive.
After leaving our gift purses at the orphanage, our group began to walk back to the carriage. The driver had followed us most of the way through the streets, but the carriage couldn't fit down the narrow alleys in this part of the city. I was happy to walk again. It helped me think. Playing with Lucy and the others had been surprisingly fun. She had a boldness that reminded me a little of myself when I was little, but was seemingly unconcerned with people's reactions. It was impossible to be reticent around her. She had been intelligent, too. Intelligent and brave. She'd achieve great things if given the chance. I moved to walk beside Holt. I want to call a council meeting when we get back, I said. He nodded. Are you planning to make a bigger donation? I'm planning to get them what they need. Surely I could find some way to fund a real place for the children to live. I'll see that it's done.
22. We could do so much, I said to Fitzroy for at least the fourth time that night.
Just think about it. We have so many empty manors in the city after the attack. We could easily give one to them. We could even make it a day school as well, for children who can't afford tutors. Everyone would have a chance to learn. I was practically bouncing on the spot from excitement, but Fitzroy didn't look convinced.
I don't think people will be happy if you take away their houses, he said, leaning against the central table of the lab. They still belong to somebody, and how will you pay for it all?
The court is full of gold, I said. We could easily sell some of it.
And what about when that runs out? How will you get more?
That's far in the future, I said, even though I knew he was right. But the gold was wasted in the palace, and we had time to come up with more solutions. We could ask people to pay to stay at court. We could trade more abroad. We could do lots of things.
Maybe sell this poison detector?
Maybe, if we ever figure it out. I turned back to my notes. Nothing had really reacted with the arsenic solution so far. The closest thing to a breakthrough had come from mixing the powder with spirit of nitre. It had dissolved, reluctantly, and when I distilled the result, it left glassy crystals behind, almost like salt. It probably wouldn't work as a test, but something was happening there. What if I added something else to make the reaction more obvious, something to catalyze it? I'd try metals first.
Could you prepare me some more baths of spirit of nitre? I said to Fitzroy as I climbed off the stool.
Got another plan?
Something like one. I crossed the room and considered the jars of metals. I began to weigh out some copper. Beside me, Fitzroy pulled on his gloves, ready to measure the acid.
I guess you never thought you'd be doing anything like this, I said softly. What, playing with acid in the old torture room? That's how I've always spent my evenings.
I smiled. Then Naomi's teasing words came back to me. It wasn't possible that Fitzroy liked me, not in the way she had joked. It wasn't possible for me to like him,
not considering all that had happened, not when I hardly even knew him. He was a presence that I was always aware of. My skin prickled when he accidentally brushed against me. My heart was beating a little faster as I thought of him, yes. And yes, scientifically, when I gathered that evidence together, perhaps an impartial observer would hear those facts and reach that conclusion. Possibly. But they'd be wrong. However, a lot of things weren't entirely logical right now. Like why Fitzroy was still here when he'd known Sten so much longer, when he had no evidence that I hadn't been involved. Why did you stay here? He was quiet for a long moment. What do you mean? When Sten left, you've known him for years and you don't hate him. You've barely known me a couple of weeks and I'm not... I removed the copper from the scales. I'm not likely to win this. Anyone with good sense would have left. So why did you stay? Lots of reasons, he said. I think Sten's wrong. You didn't kill my father, and you definitely don't deserve to die. I think you'll be a good queen, and travel is so annoying. All that dust and never having anywhere to sleep? Why would I choose that? I laughed, but the tension remained in my chest. Plus, he added, his voice slightly lower. I could sense him arranging the vials beside me, still working, constantly moving. I like you. I turned my head to look at him. He was studying the jars. You like me? Of course. What's not to like? He was speaking so casually. What did he mean? Was he saying he liked me as in, we're friends, of course I wouldn't betray you? Or as in, you're not an awful person and I'm happy for you to be queen? Or did he mean he liked me as in, he liked me, as in had feelings for me? I should ask him. I was definitely not going to ask him. Are you ready? I said, with more confidence than I felt. We'll start with the copper. Fitzroy raised his eyebrows at that, but then he nodded. The first two attempts yielded nothing of use. The copper was uninterested in reacting, the iron similarly bored. Then I tossed in some zinc. The reaction was almost immediate. The zinc fizzed, releasing a gas that smelled strongly of garlic. Get back, Fitzroy said. It could be poisonous. But I just stared at the gas. A reaction. I had finally gotten a reaction. A visible, testable reaction. Had I done it? I had to be sure. Quick, fetch me some food. Food? So I can poison it. I need to lace something with arsenic and then test it to make sure it works. I waved my right hand at him, already reaching for more of the powder with my left. Fetch some, quickly, quickly! Fitzroy nodded and strode out of the lab and I laughed. Spirit of nitre and zinc. I'd known the answer was lurking here somewhere. I'd known I could do it. I grabbed another bowl and filled it with more acid, ready for Fitzroy's return. When he finally came back, he carried a piece of bread with jam spread on top. It had a bite taken out of it. He must have stolen someone's supper. I sprinkled arsenic powder into the jam, stirring it with a knife until it vanished, and then took a glob of it and added it to the acid. I threw in another piece of zinc and waited. Another cloud of garlicky gas burst out. I did it, I said, as Fitzroy pulled me away from the still streaming gas. I did it! I wanted to jump up and down. I wanted to spin on the spot. I wanted to squeal. And why not? I did all three at once, the world spinning around me, already slightly dizzy from how wide I was grinning. And Fitzroy was there, grinning too, looking at me like I was someone who'd just figured out how to jump up to the moon, like I'd figured out how to fly, like I could solve all the world's mysteries if I put my mind to it. So I threw my arms around him, pulling him close, still laughing and squealing. He pressed his hands against my back, holding me steady, and another thrill ran over my skin, the sense of him so close. I giggled and twisted back to look at the central table again. Now we have to test the cake, I said, just to be sure. The poisoned sponge was growing mold in a cupboard.
I hoped the addition wouldn't affect the test.
It didn't. That test worked too. Fizzing zinc, garlic, gas. I jumped on the spot. I'd solved it. A test for arsenic. A way to save lives. A way to find the murderer, if I used it right. I hugged Fitzroy again. I could do this. I was almost there.
I went to Holt's office first thing the following morning, carrying spirit of nitre and zinc. When I told him I'd found a way to test for arsenic, he stared at me.
Are you sure?
I nodded. Watch. And I demonstrated the test, talking him through the theory as far as I understood it. Spirit of nitre is dangerous, of course, so we'll have to be careful how it's used. But the materials are common enough, so the test shouldn't be too expensive. And if we train the current tasters to use the acid safely, we could pay them for that. I mean, we'll still need tasters for a while because this is just one poison, but it's a start, isn't it? Even having a reliable test will discourage people from trying it.
Yes, Holt said. Yes, it will.
If he wasn't so dignified, I might have described his expression as a grin.
This is most impressive, Your Majesty. Most impressive. We are lucky to have you. Truly, we are.
It was simply science.
But you made the effort to do it. The Forgotten chose well in you, Your Majesty. Once we get through all this, you will be magnificent.
Thank you.
I picked at the skin around my fingernail. He'd meant to praise me, but his words were unsettling somehow. They reminded me of that woman I'd encountered in the streets, Mary.
About what happened yesterday, that woman who asked for my blessing, I don't understand why she thought that would help.
Holt templed his fingertips together.
I've told you, Your Majesty, that I believe you were chosen by the Forgotten. It is no surprise that others have reached the same conclusion, or that they would think you have divine powers of your own. The past weeks have been unusual for the kingdom, to say the least. It is not surprising that people are looking for their own explanations.
But I don't have any powers. I couldn't say I didn't then, but I don't have any powers like that.
It felt so dishonest to let people imagine that my touch, my words, could do that good. That I was somehow innately blessed.
These things can work in strange ways, Your Majesty. I think anyone expecting to wake up with a pile of money at the foot of their bed because of the kindness of the Forgotten will be very disappointed. But they find their ways to help us when they wish to. They have their agents in this kingdom, their believers, their chosen. Putting a mind like yours on the throne, that could still be their blessing.
But how can people think the Forgotten care about us, and also think that they wanted the entire old court to die?
Holt considered me in silence for a long moment.
The old court was choking this kingdom, Your Majesty. You have to weed the garden before you can plant flowers, must you not?
I stared at him. People aren't weeds.
You are right, of course, Your Majesty. I only meant we cannot always understand why the divine act as they do, but we must have faith that it will all work out for the best in the end.
But cold had settled inside me, too deep for his apology to dislodge. The Forgotten had agents in this world, he said. What if he believed he was one of them? 23. The next morning, my advisors brought more bad news. Sten had attacked the convoy to Rickstone Castle and captured all of the prisoners, and then he had taken control of the prison himself. He'd left the guards unharmed. They, he claimed, had done nothing wrong, and one had returned to the capital to warn us. The rest had defected to Sten.
He's gathering support in the south, as we expected, Holt said, his fingers trailing over a map on the table. Most of the minor nobles are siding with him, hoping for the favor of a new king, no doubt, and providing men for his cause. The Dark Woods, in the east, have also been contacted by him. We can hope they won't get involved after so many deaths. But if they believe you were the killer..."
Holt shook his head. "We have received letters from other nobles around the kingdom, telling us how loyal they are, but how difficult it is to support us, asking for lower taxes, more land, special favors. We cannot grant them all."
"Subtlety is a lost art,"
Norling said, wrinkling her nose.
"Indeed," Holt said. "Well, we could try to bribe these nobles to support us, but to be frank, Sten, with his vast fortunes, can offer them more."
"A low price to pay, if Her Majesty survives." I sucked my bottom lip under my teeth. I didn't know what to do. I had wanted all decisions to travel through me, but my advisors had been right. I really didn't know what I was talking about. I didn't know what would be best.
"We can review laws," I said slowly, "and, of course, we'll change anything that's unjust. And if land is not being used, perhaps we can find new owners for it once all this is done. But maybe we could suggest our disbelief that they'd only support the queen for monetary gain. It seems unworthy of the greatest nobles of Epria."
The words sounded utterly ridiculous, but Holt was nodding.
"Perhaps invoke the Forgotten there, too. Why would they demand land in order to support their chosen queen?"
I didn't like the idea of more lies, building a legend around me. But these wouldn't hurt anyone. We needed to do it.
"We believe Sten is staying in Newsome Manor, here," Holt said, pointing to a spot on the map about 70 miles south of the capital. "But he will not remain there for long. No doubt he has gone there because the manor has the greatest collection of old weapons and armor that we know of, beyond his own."
"You cannot support an army with a mishmash of old relics," Norling said.
"Yet he lacks the time or the skill to forge new ones. It'll help his cause that we don't have weapons or armor either. The ones we do have are more ceremonial than sharp. Even without supplies or training, he will be better prepared than we are."
"More people have been leaving the city," Norling said. "Mostly nobles, but some merchants, too. We've lost the Renshaws, and Nicholas Anderson. More will follow them."
"Do you think they're joining him?" I asked.
"It's unclear. They could just be trying to avoid the entire situation. I suppose we cannot blame them. And people are angry, Freya, with your actions."
"With what, exactly?"
"Gustav's treatise, Your Majesty.
It hardly paints the nobility in a good light. To see you distributing it..."
She shook her head.
"They think you don't respect them and the old ways, but I do have one more piece of good news. I have information on Sophia Thorne. She is not helping Sten, it seems, or providing him information. She has returned to her own lands in the West with her husband."
"Then why did she leave if she's not against me?"
"Her husband truly is sick," Norling said. "I assume she wanted to retreat from the capital before anything else occurred, like so many of our potential allies. No one wishes to be caught in the middle of this. They will all return, I am certain, once things are settled. The cowards probably expect a pardon."
"And my father, what have they done with him?"
"He is at Newsome Manor, too," Holt said. "Unharmed, we believe."
"Has Sten made any threats against him?"
"No, Your Majesty," Norling said. "He claims he is keeping your father for trial, after you have been captured, to see if he was involved in the murders, too. But he wasn't, of course he wasn't."
"Except I couldn't know that. Not for certain. All I knew was that I hadn't been involved. Would my father have been that desperate to increase our influence? I didn't think so, but it was possible. Anything was possible."
"Do you have any more evidence about who was involved in the murders?"
"Not yet, Your Majesty," Norling said. "We lost a powerful resource in Thorne, and I admit we have been distracted with more immediate matters of security.
But, Your Majesty, it grieves me to inform you that there have been more rumors about you," Holt said. "Notably, about you and William Fitzroy."
"Me and Fitzroy?"
Nobles had of course noticed that you have grown closer since the murders. Many are speculating that you intend to marry him. Perhaps that the two of you schemed together to put yourselves on the throne? Nonsense, of course. But it is sordid enough for people to enjoy spreading it. If they've noticed we weren't friends before, how could we have plotted together? They say you were concealing your relationship to protect yourselves. Absolute nonsense, but still, I must warn you again. Be wary of Fitzroy. Both because any contact with him threatens your position, and because we do not know that he was not involved. We've also lost a lot more of our guards, Norling said, into the quiet that followed Holt's statement. They seem to think they'll die if they remain. I recommend making it clear that leaving is not an option.
No, I said softly. No, I can't threaten them into staying, if they think they're going to die.
Then we must increase our remaining guards' patrols immediately, Holt said. Increase the work hours of those who remain, and we will have to recruit more people from the city.
Untrained? Untested? Norling said.
Who knows if we can trust them? What sort of men will want to become guards at such a time, with Torsten Wolf bearing down on us?
We don't have a choice, Holt snapped. We must get it done.
He sighed, pressing his hands on the table.
It will be all right. We are seeing more true believers by the day. People want to support their queen.
True believers? I sat straighter, apprehension prickling through me.
Your campaign is working. People are talking about your goodness, your new scientific discovery. Some are calling it a sign that the Forgotten want to keep you safe.
It's science, I said, not divine intervention.
But if people use it to support you, do not mistake me, Your Majesty. You still face a lot of opposition in the city, and a lot of mistrust. We are trying to stop people from speaking against you and your court, although it is difficult to do so when we have so few men at our disposal. But you have supporters, too. We can use this to our advantage.
But what advantage? I wondered, as I walked down to my lab after the meeting. What was Holt's goal? I couldn't forget his words about clearing out the weeds. If the murderer was on my side, as Sten suspected, if he had killed them for me. I had to find more evidence. I tested every part of the cake I could separate, but the results weren't particularly revealing. The arsenic was in the sponge. It was in the icing. The flakes of actual gold were safe to eat, but the rest of the cake was deadly.
It could just be in the sponge, Naomi said, peering over my shoulder at my notes.
It might have left traces on the icing after so long.
Possibly.
Then I shook my head. Then there'd be traces of it on the gold flakes, too. Unless the gold is interfering with the results. But why would it? It's unreactive. I tapped my pen on the table.
Think.
We need the recipe. It'd be pointless slipping the poison into both the cake and the icing. Too much risk. So it must have been hidden in one of the ingredients. What ingredients are in both cake and icing?
Sugar, Madeline said. Sugar and water.
It could have been hidden in the sugar. Maybe, I said. The arsenic powder would probably mix well with sugar granules, if no one looked too closely. But then the recipe would have gone wrong. It wouldn't have been sweet enough, unless the cook knew to compensate. But if someone had diluted the arsenic in water, what could we possibly do next?
The killer couldn't have added it to the palace water system. Everyone would have died, far sooner, and not only at the banquet. So someone with access to the kitchens must have added it that night, which once again narrowed the list of suspects down to pretty much anybody.
If it was in the water, Madeline closed her eyes. What if it was an accident?
The king was unwell, so what if someone was poisoning him gradually? Not enough for anyone to notice, but slowly, over time. It might look normal to anyone in the kitchens, someone doing their job, putting something in the king's water. I wouldn't be surprised if he had his own special supply.
If he did, Fitzroy said, I never heard of it.
But you think someone could have been poisoning him? I said. A different someone from the attacker at the banquet.
Or the same attacker, accidentally. Maybe someone put the poison in the wrong place, or they used too much, or something else went wrong, and a single target became the entire court.
Maybe, I said.
Then, no, that doesn't make sense. You couldn't kill an entire court with a dose meant for one person. I ran my fingers through my hair, thinking. But the water supply, that might be helpful. Could he have asked for special water at the banquet?
Special water, Madeline repeated, as in water imported from some fabulous mountain spring rumored to grant its visitors eternal life, that sort of water?
Yes, something like that. If that was the case, the water could have been poisoned long before it entered the castle and kept locked away until the cake was made.
Naomi turned to Fitzroy.
Did you hear your father mention anything like that?
He shook his head.
If he planned that, he didn't mention it to me. It might be in his letters, but my father liked to brag. If it was special, he would have told somebody, and he would have used it in other dishes, wouldn't he?
But all this speculation was pointless when we could simply perform a test.
We have to get to the palace kitchens. It's the only way we can know. We'll test the ingredients there.
Fitzroy nodded.
I'll go tonight.
We'll go tonight, I said. You can't carry everything back here, and you might miss something important.
Is that safe?
Naomi asked.
It'll have to be.
The first challenge was getting out of the fort. My guard was somewhat depleted now, but it wasn't gone, and people continued to watch both the front gate and the bridge. As queen, I could probably have ordered my way through, but I couldn't let my guards tail me through the streets. I couldn't draw attention to the investigation. In the end, dropping my guards was fairly straightforward, if unpleasant. We all retired for the night and then left the rooms through the hidden passage we'd found before. Fitzroy distracted the guard placed on the other end, and we emerged slightly damp, but otherwise unscathed. Leaving the fort itself was harder, but Fitzroy's solution was sheer brazenness. With no makeup, wearing plain dresses and coats, our hair in simple braids, Madeline, Naomi, and I blended into the background. No one would expect the queen to sneak out of her own castle, and so nobody looked too closely when I did. Fitzroy was more noticeable, so he didn't even try to hide his identity. He strode confidently to the front gate and asked the guard to open it for him and his friends.
"Getting out of harm's way, are you, Fitzroy?" the guard said. "Can't say I blame you."
"Not tonight, Mills. Just wanting to get out of these dreary walls for a while."
"Can't blame you for that either," the guard said. "Wish I could join you."
"Hang on, then."
And as simple as that, the front gate opened, the drawbridge lowered, and we escaped into the city. For the first time I'd ever seen, the palace windows were dark, the sweeping lawns untended and slightly unruly. It looked almost peaceful through the wrought iron fence, undisturbed, the river reflecting the stars. The gates had been left unguarded, fastened with a heavy padlock. Fitzroy pulled a key out of his pocket and opened it. I didn't ask where he'd gotten it.
"I think we'll be lucky," he said. "All the death should have kept away the looters."
"The looters?" He raised his eyebrows at me. "The castle is practically lined with gold," he said. "Of course people are going to take what they can, but the murders probably put them off the idea for a while." It wasn't very reassuring. Surely gold was gold, no matter what superstitions people wove around it. A little unpleasantness wouldn't stop any otherwise willing thieves. But as we followed the narrow path down the lawn, we saw no one. The scraps of floating lanterns lay in the grass, and banners flapped sadly between the trees, half ruined by the wind and rain.
"No one's been here," I said. "No one's cleaned up at all."
My voice sounded too loud, shattering the silence.
"Your advisors wanted it left untouched."
"For the investigation?"
Fitzroy nodded.
We approached the rear of the palace and the double doors that led into the ballroom.
Even now, weeks after the event, one of the doors stood slightly open, inviting us in. It was as though the entire palace had been frozen in time, stuck in the moment its court fell. The door creaked as we pushed it open and stepped inside. The feasting tables were still in place, but many of the chairs had been knocked backward, the golden plates abandoned on the floor. Doves still cooed in the rafters. Instruments lay abandoned in the corner. And there at that table, was where I had sat, where I would have died if I hadn't walked away. Madeline's eyes glistened with tears.
So this is it. This is where they all died.
This is it, Fitzroy said.
He walked the length of the hall, past the scattered chairs and jewels spilled across the floor. I turned on the spot, still staring. It was unsettling, to see the hall so empty, so quiet, disturbed in the middle of a feast and left to gather dust. Someone had clearly made a quick attempt to clean up, removed the bodies, removed the mess. But otherwise, the feast might have simply paused, as though everyone had wandered away and forgotten to return. "We need to head to the kitchens," I said. "Do you know the way?" Madeline nodded. She led us out through another door, into a corridor lit solely by moonlight. The gilt walls glimmered. Footsteps echoed down from farther down the corridor. I clutched Fitzroy's sleeve and jerked my head in the direction of the sound. Looters. What would they do if they saw us? Would they recognize me as queen? Or would they see us as rival treasure hunters, standing in their way? The passage was cluttered with statues and human-sized vases. I ducked behind one of the vases, and Fitzroy pressed behind me, pushing me even closer against its cold surface, his heart thudding against my back. Madeline and Naomi darted behind a statue of two lovers entwined. The footsteps moved closer. Fitzroy's breath brushed my ear. The person came around the corner. It was Holt. I gasped, and Fitzroy pressed a hand over my mouth to stop the sound. Holt was striding down the corridor, looking for all the world like he belonged. His cloak flapped behind him. What was he doing here? I waited until he turned the corner again, and then I slipped out from behind the vase and crept after him. Fitzroy snatched from my hand, but I pulled away. I had to see what Holt was up to. What was he doing here? Around another corner, and another. Fitzroy grabbed my arm, pulling me to his side. Stop, he hissed in my ear. I know where he's going. I raised my eyebrows at him. Where? The shrine to the Forgotten is this way. It's the only thing down here. There's a shrine in the palace? Of course. Even if my father didn't care in the slightest about the Forgotten, he wouldn't miss a chance to show off his gold. I nodded and stepped forward again, but he pulled me back. Wait. We can look once he's gone. What good will that be? We can see what he's done without him seeing us. I wanted to argue further, but he did have a point. If Holt saw us, we'd have no chance of uncovering whatever secrets he was hiding, and he'd know we'd been here. Investigating. I couldn't let him know that, not until we could rule him out as a suspect. So I waited, tucked in an alcove by a statue, twisting the ends of my hair around my fingers, my friends beside me. None of us spoke. Why was Holt here? Surely, if he had an innocent reason, he wouldn't have come in the dark, alone. But what could he possibly be doing? The minutes crawled by. Then more footsteps, and Holt hurried past again. I peered around the statue. Holt was carrying a sack in his arms, like its contents were precious beyond words. Once he was out of sight, I stepped into the corridor and paused for Fitzroy to lead the way. But when we got there, the shrine was empty. A little moonlight fell through the narrow windows, but no gold glinted, no statues loomed, no relics decorated the walls. There were a few wooden pews and a wooden altar at the front, but otherwise, nothing. Or not quite nothing. Flowers had been left on the altar. I stepped closer. They were fresh, the petals still bright and blooming.
Well, the looters have been here, Fitzroy said. There was more, much more. There was gold plate
and tapestries, jewels embedded in the walls. It's all gone.
Halt, I said. Do you think he stole them?
He'd been carrying something precious, but he wouldn't steal from the Forgotten.
Maybe, Madeline said. If he convinced himself it wasn't stealing, he thinks the old court was too extravagant, doesn't he? Maybe he considered the gold an affront to the Forgotten.
How convenient, Fitzroy said.
I picked one of the flowers off the altar. The petals were smooth under my fingertips. This was what Holt considered a suitable offering. Fresh, delicate, pure. I was tempted to put the flower in my bag, as evidence, but I paused. It was a genuine offering, and although I didn't believe in the Forgotten myself, I didn't want to disrupt that. I laid it carefully on top and turned back to the others. Let's go down to the kitchens, I said, before somebody else comes along. 24. The kitchens were near the banquet hall, down a twisting staircase that, although unadorned, matched the opulence of the rest of the palace. It was certainly nicer than any part of the fort, lined with neat white stone and sweeping metal banisters. The kitchen itself was two huge red brick rooms. Ovens covered one wall, and there was a large table in the middle of the room, still covered with chopping boards and knives and abandoned pans. More pans hung from hooks on the walls, and hundreds of empty plates were piled up on the side. Where we looked depended on when the cake had been made. There were no traces of the cake or its ingredients on the center table, so I strode into the second room and started searching through the cupboards instead.
Empty sugar sacks over here, Fitzroy said.
Put them on the center table. Madeline, Naomi, look for anything that might have contained water, especially if it has any fancy labeling on it, Naomi said. Yes, and I would look around for other clues, the cake recipe perhaps, or remnants of the gold decorations. I found nothing. The sugar tested negative for arsenic, and we couldn't find any signs that water had been imported for the cake. I scraped my hands through my hair. There had to be something. What else goes into cake and icing? I said. What have we missed? What about coloring? Naomi said slowly. The cake was golden yellow. Right? What if the poison was hidden in there? Madeline gripped the table. All the color rushed from her face. No, she said in a strangled squeak. Oh, no. Madeline? I ran over and grabbed her shoulder. She looked like she was about to be sick. What's wrong? The color, she said. What if it was in the color? What do you mean? She let out a shaky breath. There's a color, a beautiful vivid green that has arsenic as one of its ingredients. It's fine, you don't eat it, but artists, when artists use it, they get lines on their fingernails, black and white ridges, from the poison. She scraped at her own painted thumbnail until a bare patch peeked through. She held it out to me. White lines ran across the nail. See? That's just from painting with it. I don't know what color was used in the cake, but what if it had arsenic as an ingredient, too? If nobody knew that? What if it was an accident? What if nobody meant it at all? Naomi frowned. Why would you put poison in your paints? Because artists will do anything to create the exact color they want. As long as they don't eat the paints, it's not going to kill them. But if someone didn't know, if they got a new color, an exciting, rare color that also contained arsenic, and they baked it into the cakes would have been full of it. Every piece, every single bite of it. It's just dye, just color. If you saw it and you didn't know... Oh, no, no, no. She sank onto a kitchen stool. What if they died for nothing? Nothing at all. We don't know that, I said. We don't even know if there was poison in the dye. And if there was, someone could have used it on purpose. We don't know. We have to find it first. We searched through jars, looking for even a hint of the dye. The rich smell of spices tickled my nose, but we didn't find anything even vaguely gold or yellow. Four large jars, like those that held spices, had been left on the side of the counter. I hurried over and pulled off the lids. Nothing but darkness inside.
I moved the lamp closer. The first jar was scraped clean. The second was the same. But in the third, a little yellow powder clung to the sides and to the base. Here, I found it. It was difficult to tell in the dim light, but it looked the same as the cake. And how much yellow gold powder could there be in a kitchen? I used a spatula to scrape a few clumps of the yellow powder out of the jar and deposit them in the zinc and niter bowl. The dye dissolved. The zinc fizzed. Garlic smoke exploded out of the bowl. My friends flinched back, but I stayed close, staring at the bubbling metal, the powder dissolving into nothing. Here it was. Here was the answer. I'd expected to feel more excited, more accomplished. Now I just stared at the mixture, horrifying certainty settling into my stomach. This was how the murderer had done it. This was what had killed them. "All right," I said. "All right. We found the source of the poison, so now we need to find the source of the dye." Madeline let out a shaky breath. "It wasn't necessarily an accident," I said. "It couldn't be. If it had been an accident, I had no defense against Sten. No one would believe me, not even if I had all the evidence in the world. It's a possibility, but we have to keep investigating. We have to assume someone planned this." I picked up the jar. It was heavy and awkward to hold, but I wasn't going to risk scraping out more powder now. I needed to take the rest back to the lab.
"Well then, what are you lot doing down here?"
I jumped. Two men stood in the doorway, each holding a large sack. I could see gold candlesticks and decorative cups peeking through the top of each. I tightened my grip on the jar and stepped back. My hip banged against the counter. If they realized I was queen. But they wouldn't. Why would the queen be here, in the kitchens, dressed as simply as this? They'd think we were other looters, at worst.
"After the spices as well, are you?"
Madeline stepped forward, smiling prettily, all trace of paleness and panic gone.
"Oh, sirs," she said. "Are you here to help with the cleanup? We've been struggling here. The Queen's Council told us that more men would be following along soon enough. We've been here trying our best, but, well, we're not near strong enough to move everything by ourselves."
She watched them expectantly, that pleasant, hopeful smile still on her face. The man stared at her.
"That's right," he said. "We're just here to help out."
"Excellent. Oh, but you seem to have run out of sacks. I think there are some piled in that closet. Let us check for you."
She began to walk toward the door, but the man stepped forward.
"Hang on," he said. He reached for my jar. "Let me take this. It looks cumbersome."
"No," I said, fighting not to stutter. "I'm all right."
"What's in there? Spices?"
"Rubbish," I said. "Things I swept up." I didn't sound particularly convincing.
"I'll take it. Dispose of it for you."
Logic said I should give him the jar. If he opened it, he'd find nothing worthwhile inside and discard it. It was the safest course of action, the most sensible thing to do. I knew that. I knew it even as I flinched away from him, my arms tightening around the jar. I knew it even as I knew my actions had been suspicious, that he'd never believe it was worthless now. The man snatched for the jar. I dodged back, but I didn't move quickly enough. His fingers scraped against the ridges around the rim, and his nails found purchase. He tugged as I pulled away, throwing me off balance. The heavy jar teetered, and I tried to tighten my grip, but the man snatched again, and it fell. The pottery smashed on the floor. I dove after it. "You idiot!" I shoved the shards aside. One rough edge scraped my finger, drawing blood. There had to be some dye left. Something stuck to the pot. But I could barely see in the darkness, and the floor was dusty, unswept since the night of the banquet. I couldn't see anything.
"Freya!"
Naomi grabbed my arm and hauled me backward. Madeline ran for the wooden door, wrenching it open to reveal another dark corridor beyond. Naomi yanked me along, too, half dragging me across the room and into the corridor as Fitzroy ran behind us. One of the men shouted, but Madeline did not stop. Honey brown hair streamed out behind her as she led us up the stairs, through doors, up and around and out into the palace gardens again. My sides burned. I could barely breathe, but I kept running, gripping Naomi's hand, the taste of grass choking in the back of my throat, until we were out on the city streets again. "I don't think they followed us," Naomi said when we stopped for breath. "Just didn't want us to interfere." I leaned against a wall, gasping. "We lost it," I said. "We lost the dye. We lost the proof." "But we still know," Madeline said. "We know what caused it." "No, you don't understand. Without the dye, I couldn't prove it. Why would anyone believe me without proof? I have to prove it wasn't me. How can I do that now? It's lost in the dust." "The dye didn't prove that," Naomi said softly. "It was just a start. And you still know it's poisonous. You'll find something else." I nodded, my breath rushing out through my teeth. She was right. There was no point in panicking now. We still knew the dye was responsible. We had something. "We need to go through the letters again," I said. "If we can find where he ordered it from, or who might have suggested it to him, that's what we have to do." The letters were less than helpful. It was easy to tell which notes had been taken by a scribe and which had been written by the king himself. The scribe's handwriting was always elaborate but clear, their pens flowing across the pages. The king's writing was nigh illegible, a mixture of jagged scratches and ostentatious loops. But as I tried to decipher the words on page after page, reading his comments on proposed laws and taxation decisions, and pleas from his advisors to find a new wife who might give him legitimate heirs, I had to admit that he, too, was not exactly as I thought. Yes, his court was wasteful, dramatic to the point of ridiculousness, but he'd responded with care to every issue presented to him, and there were so many issues, as many as I had faced and more, a deluge of needs and questions and problems to be faced. But then I'd pull another page from the pile and see his demands for more and more, more jewels for the queen, more clothes, new paintings to fill the supposedly empty parts of the palace, a better cook, additional guards, more and more things, while he waved away concerns about finances with a casual flick of his pen. Then, after what felt like 100 useless pages, I found something. Fitzroy looked up from his own pile of papers. "What was that?" "Here." I scanned the page again to be sure. "Listen to this. We're continuing the search for King's Yellow, as Your Majesty requested. The people here call it orpiment, and they tell us that it can cure all manner of impossible ailments. One must suspect they are merely trying to raise the price, but we will continue to negotiate." I looked up. "King's Yellow? That would fit." "But it sounds like he's talking about a medicine, not a color," Naomi said. "Who would confuse arsenic with medicine?" "It is a medicine," I said. I'd heard it before, the details lurking deep in my brain. "I think. I'm not sure." I flicked through the pile of letters as though the answer would be hiding there. "I've heard of it being used, in very small amounts, when someone is very sick, to purge the sickness out of them." "Madeline," Fitzroy said, "have you ever heard of a color called King's Yellow before?" She shook her head. "Never. The dye didn't look familiar to me. I've never seen that exact shade before. But if my father discovered something new, of course he'd name it after himself." "There's more," I said, flicking back to the letter again. "We are told the mineral forms in the hot springs in the mountains, which explains the extreme expense and why, as Your Majesty believed, it is only available in Rezhka. We send another sample to Your Majesty with this letter. If the quality is satisfactory and the price good, we will acquire more." The king's written something else at the bottom. I peered at the scribbled handwriting. "Spare no expense." The letter was dated a few months ago. "Madeline, you said the king was unwell, didn't you?
He had some stomach complaint. So what if someone gave him this dye as a potential cure for his illness? The golden wine, Fitzroy said slowly. I looked at him in confusion.
My father's wine looked gold. I noticed it a couple of months ago. I assumed it was just his goblets changing color, but
what if he dyed it instead? If he was taking King's Yellow as a medicine, he could have mixed it with the wine. It would have suited his arrogance. And then he was so impressed by the medicine that he decided to make a show of it in the banquet?
Madeline shook her head. If he found a magical cure for his illness, he wouldn't share it like that. He'd hoard it all for himself.
Perhaps he wanted to show it off, I said. If it's a rare and expensive medicine, what better way to show how rich and powerful he is than to throw all of that away at a banquet? On his birthday? Like a declaration that he's well again and he can do whatever he likes.
I don't know, Freya, Fitzroy said. If it was rare enough to shout about, why didn't he shout about it?
True. But there had to be something in here. We had a name, King's Yellow, and a source. We knew it was rare and expensive, but they were scientific answers, not explanations. Who had introduced the king to it in the first place, if even Madeline had never heard of this dye? Had it been an accident, or had someone prompted him to do it? And was the poison in the dye he'd ordered, or had someone changed them along the way? I placed the paper to one side and continued to read. 25. I watched Holt closely at the council meeting the next morning. He looked tired, but he didn't look guilty, and he didn't seem to know that I'd been in the palace, too. I wanted to ask him what he'd been doing there, accuse him of some connection to the murders, but I swallowed the words down, 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 until I nearly choked on their bitterness. I didn't know that he was involved. Not yet. And if he was involved, and I revealed what I knew too early, I could lose the chance to prove it. We are running out of time, Norling said. Stannis swept east and is marching back to the capital. The Darkwoods have joined him, as have the Solbergs, with all of their own resources at his disposal. The kingdom is against you, your majesty, and Sten will not hold back when he arrives. How many men does he have?
I was almost afraid to hear the answer.
10,000. And how many men do we have?
Trained guards and soldiers, Norling said. Perhaps 30. I would estimate around 20,000 people remain in the city, but most will not fight for you. You have gained some supporters, your majesty, but most people want to survive. And if staying quiet and allowing Sten into the walls is the best way to do that, that is what they will do. I suggest that you run now, before it becomes impossible to leave.
No, Holt said. She cannot run. If she leaves, she will forfeit the crown.
At least this way she will live.
She'll live, Holt said.
But for how long?
Sten will hunt her down, and without the crown to protect her, how will she hide from him? Where could she go? She couldn't possibly hope to evade him forever. And then what will happen to the kingdom? It will be stuck with a blasphemous usurper rather than their rightful queen. We cannot allow it. We must stay and fight.
Fight? Norling laughed. Fight how? This isn't going to be a civil war, Rasmus. This will be a massacre.
Her words rang in the silence. I'd known, of course, that my chances against Sten were slim. But to hear my closest advisor insisting that I was going to die, my first instinct was to run to the library, pull out books on military strategy, history books about battles where impossibly small forces defeated their larger enemies, but what would be the point? I couldn't become a better strategist than Sten or my advisors in a few days. I could only win through invention. It had taken me years of study to be able to think inventively in the lab, and now I had to pretend I could learn how to think inventively in battle by the end of the week.
Norling, I said quietly, you've always advised me to appear strong before, to return to the palace, to punish people, to fight. But now, you want me to run. Isn't that weak, too?
Perhaps, Your Majesty.
I have always advised you because I want your reign to be strong. But now, I am concerned for your safety now, Your Majesty. I am concerned for you.